This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello there. A very happy Friday afternoon to you. Glad you could spend some time here on the Country Hour this afternoon. Just before one, Danny Burkett's going to be along, and he's going to go through this week's wool sales up again this week. Is this like an 8-week run at this stage? I think it is. Danny will have all the details for you there. And also, alarm bells are ringing today because DPIRD's latest stock assessments show fish species like pink snapper, red emperor and jewfish are under serious threat.
I believe that the government's got two choices. Either they bring in compulsory mandatory real-time reporting for the West Coast demersal boat fishery, or they shut the fishery down for the next 10 years.
We'll get into that conversation after the news headlines at 12:30 today, 12:06, here on the ABC right across Western Australia. First up today, Western Australia is on track to produce a record-breaking crop of over 25 million tonnes. Now, the industry isn't there yet. The official estimate is sitting at 23.68 million tonnes. But after another month of mild temperatures and regular rain, the state's grain yield potential continues to improve. Michael Lamond is the author of the Grain Industry Association of WA Crop Report, and he's just released the September update. Michael, will it be a record crop?
Well, there's a lot of things in the crop's favour, Belinda. One is it's a record area in crop, 9.2 million hectares. In the previous two very high tonnage years, 21 and 22, there was around 9. So there's about 200,000 hectares more, and a lot of that is in the higher rainfall areas. So, you know, we've got a big crop in the ground. The crop growth is good right across the state. There are some sort of patchy bits, but it's pretty well wall-to-wall good, and the last month has been sensational for the crop growth. It hasn't been any hot weather, although the crop has slowed down in its development, which is going to pose a risk, which we can talk about in a second, but the crop biomass is there. It's got huge biomass. It's got huge potential. There's a lot of things in its favour, but there's also quite a few risks ahead as well.
But you wouldn't be surprised if we're on track for 25 million or slightly over.
Well, I mean, you'd have to say right at the moment it probably could get there, although there's a few things, like, for example, the lateness of the crop is a problem. It's very late in development. And during the mild conditions over the last month particularly, the crop development has slowed down. It's bulked up, which is a good thing. Bulking up gives it high potential yield. But the thing is, being so late, once we get heat, it'll transpire itself to death very quickly, you know, if it runs out of subsoil moisture. And the subsoil moisture levels aren't that high. So even though the rainfall has been very good in July, August and the start of September across the grain belt, total rainfall year to date is not particularly high. It's about average. So, you know, you've got to say, okay, well, when the heat comes on, is the amount of subsoil moisture going to support that huge top growth? And that's a question.
Let's have a look back over the years, because if we go back to 2021, that harvest produced 24 million tonnes. Mm-hmm. 2022, 25 million tonnes. So that's the record year. How does this crop compare to what we saw in those years?
Well, in 22, there was no frost at all. And this year we've had quite a lot of frost events. There've been a lot of little ones, and there's been a couple of severe ones in the Lakes District and Esperance. So, and a lot of the growers, you know, when we had no frost at all, they realised that, you know, frost does take the top off here and there. So, you know, we've got frost this year. We have a very different crop mixture this year than we had in 22. In 22, and historically, say, for the last 10 years, our wheat area has been around 54%, or like mid-50s to even sometimes higher percentage of total crop area. So having a large percentage of the crop in wheat, you know, the wheat's a lot more forgiving as far as yield goes. It generally yields higher than, say, canola and lupins. But this year, the crop area that's gone into wheat is only 47%. It's about a 10% drop in area sown this year from last year. So that increase in area, or the remainder of that area, has been taken up by barley, canola, lupins, oats and pulses. And apart from barley, and oats to some extent, they generally yield less. So even though there's more area in the ground and it's in the high rainfall area, the area has been taken up by generally lower yielding crops and crops that are probably a little bit more erratic in their final yield. So that could be a big factor. But on the plus side, the barley area is big. It's the second largest barley crop on record. You know, there's about 1.9 million hectares of barley in the ground. There was 1.95 in 19 just prior to the trade to China cutting out. And then in that year, in 19, 23% of the crop area was barley, but it was only 8.3 million hectares of crop. So, you know, 900,000 hectares less. So having that very different crop mix it makes it a little bit harder to sort of just say confidently that we're going to get that 25 million ton, because, you know, things like the lupins, for example, have got a lot of biomass, but not a lot of grain. And the canola is a bit the same. The canola is quite late. It has got a lot of biomass, but it's still got a way to go as far as grain fill goes. So those are a little unknown, and they sort of make you sort of question whether we could actually get to that, you know, 25 million tonne again.
What are the main challenges then, the concerns between now and harvest? And you touched on them earlier. Heat, obviously, is a main one to be aware of.
Well, heat's that's the one that's at most risk in front of us right now, because we know there's going to be a warm week next week. So it doesn't look like to be too much wind, but the heat, you know, like consecutive days of heat, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 days of heat, you know, in the high 20s and low 30s, is going to really put the brakes on the crop grain fill. And any of the wheat that's still flowering is going to come under pressure. The canola that's still sort of the mid stages of grain fill is going to come under pressure. So that's the immediate risk. Doesn't look like any rain coming. And the other one, of course, is frost, particularly in those southern areas. Although, you know, in their favour, the southern areas, the crops are more advanced and they're, you know, generally well into grain fill. So it's the crops that are later in the southern areas that will still be, you know, right up until the end of the first week in October that will be at risk at frost.
And despite those risks, how certain are you that the crop will at least be 20 million tonnes?
Oh, 100%. 100%. It's not going to be less than 20 now. It's just, there's too many, it's too good. Too good. There's too much area in the ground. And, you know, whilst there's some challenges, you know, the next few weeks, it'll equal last year no matter what happens now.
It's remarkable, isn't it? I mean, looking back over the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, the numbers that are coming out, those tons that are coming out of this state.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, in the last 5 years, we'll have four of those 5 years will be greater than 20 million tonnes. Prior to that, there was none at 20 million tonnes. And it's not just crop area, because, you know, like the crop area has been going up, and that is having a big part to play. When you go back to, you know, prior to sort of like down, you know, say back to 2017, 18, 19 and 20, it was more in the mid eights to low 8 million hectares. So the area is having quite an influence, although, it's other things that have an influence as well.
Really good to get the update, Michael. Appreciate it.
Okay. Good day, Belinda.
Michael Lamond is the author of the Grain Industry Association of WA Crop Report, and WA on track to possibly break the record with over 25 million tonnes. We'll watch this space, 13 past 12. Well, in other grains industry news, growers in the Lakes District in the state's southeast are dealing with a small beetle that feeds on plant roots and can cause severe damage to crops, significantly reducing yields. It does have a very unfortunate name. It's called the cockchafer. And for those farmers dealing with it, it's no laughing matter. Tom Dunham farms near Lake Grace, 320 kilometres southeast of Perth, and has been dealing with the pest for the past 10 years.
I suppose you'd explain, is it a witchetty grub sort of looking thing, a white grub with legs and pincers, and they'll come through underground and just eat the roots off the plants, and the plants will just, basically fall over and die from lack of nutrition and water.
Look, first things first, I think we need to address the name, the cockchafer. Like, obviously, when you first hear it, you do laugh. But I don't think you're really at the point anymore, Tom Hay, when you're laughing about it.
It is a pretty out there name. I don't know where it's come from, but it's been a stitch up for me, that's for sure. Yeah, look, we've been seeing damage for probably 10 years now to varying levels. And where they are, it is quite significant. It'll wipe out basically any crop that's in that area.
So you said that you've detected the cockchafer here for many years. Just take me back to that first time it was found on your property.
Yeah, so it was at the home farm. Dad actually found it. Wasn't growing anything. The plants just looked like they were dying. We couldn't really put our finger on what it was. And, yeah, got suggested to have a dig around and just see what's going on. And, started pulling up heaps and heaps of these beetles the grubs in a shovelful. Yeah, sort of gathered that's what it was, and yeah, just sort of kept looking after that where we started seeing the damage. So,
and once you started looking, did you just find them continuously?
Yeah, like in that area, we saw them for quite a few years. They're not actually in that paddock anymore. They're sort of shifted further on, but yeah, we're sort of finding them more and more throughout different paddocks and across different farms.
How much damage do you think you guys have had over the years then in total?
It's a bit of a job to put a number on it because it is so variable, and I think that's what the guys are having trouble with, trying to find data in the trials that they've been doing. It's sort of like some paddocks when it's its worst might be 4-5% kind of thing, and where there's like minimal damage is, you know, it's not that bad, but it's just, you know, that it's going to get bigger and bigger as the years go on, kind of thing.
Yeah. Where we're standing at the moment is in one of your paddocks. Just describe to me, what crop is this in front of us and the damage we're looking at here?
Yeah, so we've got Maximus barley out here. It struggled a little bit for moisture earlier on. It's coming through pretty good, but we sort of noticed this is actually the first time I've seen them in this site. Noticed them coming down the laneway, and so it started off as like a yellowing plant, and then you see them, you know, as they die a bit more, they start falling over. And they've basically shifted, I don't know, they've probably come 300 metres down a hill, hit a laneway and sort of stopped the spread of it, I guess. But they've wiped out what's here, basically, yeah.
This is barley, but it's not just impacting barley crops, am I right in saying that?
No, that's right. So originally we thought it was just cereals that were being affected, and particularly coming off of pastures, but in our continuous crop paddocks we started seeing them as well, and lupins and neighbour's canola was getting affected as well.
What's the solution here, Tom? What have you tried to do?
We tried various things over the years, different chemicals before rain, just trying to get chemical into the root zone. We've actually refinated areas before and we thought that'd stitch them up, but they were there that following year.
Just quickly, what do you mean by refinating for people that aren't aware of what that is? I'm sure a lot of the listeners are, but me, what is it?
Yeah, it's like a ripper that comes through and basically rips up ironstone with a big crusher and roller behind it, sort of rips to 300 mil and, yeah, fairly hefty ribbed roller on the back of it to crush it up. So we really thought that would have done some work, but didn't seem to do anything.
When did you do that?
That would have been in February into March.
That must have been so frustrating when you've done all that and then seeing this type of damage just pop up.
Yeah, it stunned us really, because we thought they would have been there, but we thought our theory was they must have come in and laid their grubs or whatever they're laying after we've refinated. So yeah, I'm not sure what the timeline is on there.
And from what you've told me before, Tom, as well, is they kind of run on like a two-year cycle, or you think they might run on a two-year cycle, so they'll be really bad for a couple of years and then not so bad.
Yeah, that's sort of what Dusty and that have said to us. We sent samples away and can't remember exactly how long they had them alive for, but they ended up perishing before they could get them to full size. But it sort of seems to follow that track, like 1 year will be a bit worse than the next kind of thing. But yeah, I haven't got data or anything for that, yeah.
You just mentioned the name Dusty. That's Dee Purd's research scientist behind the cockchafer. You've obviously been working closely with him then?
More so Consult Ag, but I've been obviously helping out with samples and, yeah, sites to get samples kind of thing. So, yeah, Ben and Justine They've probably been a bit more into that.
But, so Ben is someone with Consult Ag that's looking at it, and then DPIRD and GRDC are also coming at it. How does that feel, though, that there is that kind of groundswell?
Yeah, it is. It's good to get, well, good but not good, that it's getting some traction, like with obviously more growers have been affected. It sort of seemed like for a long time it was just us for the whole area kind of thing. So, yeah, people seeing it now, or if it has actually spread, or whether they're just noticing it, I'm not sure. But yeah, definitely good to get some trial work and some data done on them. Yeah.
So you were almost like ground zero of the cockchafer.
Coughing that for a while. Yeah, definitely ground zero for what we've noticed anyway.
Yeah. Back in the 90s, Tom, I am told that the cockchafer showed itself at Harrismith in the wheat belt, again, caused massive financial and yield loss. Is different to the variety, I understand, though, what we're dealing with now. Have you been able to learn anything from what those farmers were dealing with back then, if we are dealing with a whole variety, different variety?
It sort of seemed like, yeah, they were a different species, and that data sort of, I don't know if it was that old, it wasn't accessible or didn't quite fit what we were dealing with here. Guys definitely tried to have a look at it to see if there was anything, you know, I could link up and try and do anything there, but yeah, it just didn't seem to be viable for what we're doing out here.
Have you been in touch with any of those farmers out there just trying to like pick their brains what they did?
No, I don't know. I don't actually know who was affected. Probably before my time I was really thinking of anything of that. So yeah, I don't know who was affected, but feel free to reach out if you got some info for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was obviously Harrismith in the wheat belt. We're in Lake Grace at the moment, and this, what I've been told, it is an isolated issue to the Lakes District, but I've seen shots of like drone footage of this area, and when you see that footage, it is like jaw-dropping stuff, the overall impact. So yes, it may be isolated, but I'm sure you're wanting much more awareness around this.
Yeah, so it sort of sounds like there's been reports of some up like Pingaring, Condinan up there as well. Again, I'm not sure who those growers are, but it sort of sounds like it is out there a bit further than what we first thought as well. But yeah, definitely good to get some boots on the ground and get some stuff done.
Tom Dunham farms at Lake Grace. He was speaking to Kate Forrester about the ongoing issues they're having with the cockchafer. And on Monday's Rural Report and the Country Hour, you'll hear from some other farmers in the district dealing with this pest, and also the researchers who are working with the farmers to try and solve the problem. You can also tune in to Sunday night's 7 o'clock TV news to actually see what this cockchafer looks like and the extent of damage that it's caused. 22 past 12. A regenerative food systems conference held in Perth this week has looked at all sorts of factors associated with soil health and sustainable farming practices. But many of WA's so-called conventional farmers are still sceptical about anything associated with the term regen ag. Some farmers question the financial sustainability of such a farming methodology, especially on poor soils in parts of the state's Southwest Land Division. One of the keynote speakers at the conference addressed those concerns. Her name's Associate Professor Hannabeth Luke. She's a specialist in sustainable agriculture and says the scepticism comes from a belief that regen ag is an all or nothing concept.
But I think for some reason, I think there is some resistance. I don't know exactly where it came from, but the names don't really matter. It's about the actions that people are doing. And this was backed up by my PhD student, Matt Alexanderson's work. And he found that farmers who were trying new practices, so planting perennial pastures, encouraging native grasses to grow, planting more legumes, trying out multi-species, they might just dip a toe in and try something out. And then they start to go along to field days and meet other people who are doing other things might be aimed at, you know, looking more at the ecology. And then you can build confidence over time. It doesn't necessarily have to be a complete rapid change. And in fact, the evidence shows changing everything at once isn't really the best way to go anyway. So slowly, slowly is also fine.
So what I'm hearing is it's definitely not a black and white thing. Do you think that maybe it needs to be changed in how it's promoted as being this them versus us sort of thing?
I don't know who's promoting it as them versus us. I've never actually seen anything in evidence of that. I've been working in the space for 5 years. I think some people might feel defensive. What I have heard in the past is that we don't need reductionist science and things like that, whereas 100% we do. We need all hands on deck. We need the best science, but we also need to understand how that science fits together and value those different types of knowledges, which include Indigenous understandings of how things work. So moving forward, yeah, it's about how these things work together rather than in isolation or silos.
If you had a neighbour come to you and say, I'm really interested in regenerative farming, but I'm so scared of going bust or financially things going poorly for me, what would you say to them?
I've been thinking about this for a very long time now, and what I'm seeing is that what we have in our agricultural systems at the moment is typically you've got really high-risk systems. You've got high inputs and high outputs. I saw a graph yesterday that showed that that actual profit margin has been going down as input prices, whether it's nitrogen or whether it's the machinery prices, they're soaring. So it's actually a way at reducing risk, and I think that's a really important message. It's a way of potentially moving away from high inputs, high outputs into, hang on a minute, let's take a step back, see how my system's working. Be open to having some conversations with some farmers, and some of the things you can read out there are really quite simple and straightforward to get your head around it and take those first steps.
And you've just sent some mail out this week. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so right now, this week, I have happen to have 4,000 survey booklets landing in mailboxes across landholders in rural areas of Western Australia. That's a part of my work with the Soil CRC. We've been doing this work for 6 years now. We've sent about 16,000 of these out across Australia, and it's all about understanding what is happening for land managers. What are the practices they're doing? What are their knowledge about those practices? What challenges are they facing? And what are their goals and aspirations to the future? And what's getting in the way? Please fill in that survey, because look, yes, I know we're all getting over-surveyed these days, but we will make sure that that information goes into strategic planning at a local to national scale.
Murdoch University's Hannabeth Luke, who's an Associate Professor of Sustainable Agricultural Development, speaking to Anna Cox about regenerative agriculture. 27 past 12. The latest report from the peak body representing Australia's vegetable industry says most growers are financially worse off than they were last year, and about 40% are considering exiting. AusVeg's Vegetable Industry Sentiment Report found increasing input costs and poor retail prices are to blame. Vegetables WA CEO Peter Spackman says given the amount of pressure growers face, the findings aren't surprising, but they are concerning for all of us.
Nearly all the fresh and healthy vegetables grown in Western Australia are consumed in Western Australia. So the concern is if 40% of the growers leave, there's going to be a food security issue in Western Australia when there's not going to have enough on the shelf for people to buy fresh local produce. So we either bring it in from the eastern seaboard, but I think they're in exactly the same position, or we'll find ourselves eating canned corn and beans out of China.
As the head of, you know, Vegetables WA, it's obviously the group representing vegetable growers in Western Australia. How did you feel hearing that a significant portion of them are looking to leave?
Fortunately, not a great surprise. There's been significant pressure on the industry for a long time, and these are just, you know, small to medium family businesses, you know, trying to just make a living and working the land. But they're under a considerable amount of pressure through a number of compliance costs and poor retail pricing to reflect the increasing pressure on them. You know, they're in a worse financial situation than they were 12 months ago. 62% of the respondents declared that that's the case. And furthermore, there's more than 50% of them feel it's actually going to get worse in the next 12 months, not better. So the confidence out there is, you know, quite concerning. And there is a real concern in regard to those actual increasing costs and how and whether they can recover those.
The report says farmers currently rate productivity as average at best, and it did identify a few ways to increase productivity, one of those being reforming regulation and compliance. You know, you mentioned compliance being one of those issues, one of those challenges that growers are facing. How would you like to see these reforms done, and can it be done without compromising things like food health or food safety and biosecurity?
The It can be done. Most definitely shouldn't compromise food safety in any way or form, or occupation, health and safety, or worker safety. But it can be done. There's a lot of overlapping and a lot of inconsistency. Just the certification requirements, which is by and large administration work, is about 31% of those costs. Accounting costs, increasing pesticides and fertilizer costs, international workforce costs, because we were unable to secure local labour to help out during the harvest periods, harvest testing of the produce, training, water costs, industrial relations costs, weights and measures. So there's a lot of additional costs which are building throughout the year, but there's a lot that can be done to consolidate some of those programs and compliance certifications where it can reduce that cost and just make it easier for the growers.
The report also found if consumers bought and ate more vegetables, that could make a really big difference for growers. And I feel like the facts are out there. You know, everyone knows or should know vegetables are good for you. They should be on your plate. But also, understandably, with the cost of living crunch, some things haven't quite made the cut on people's grocery lists. So how do we boost consumption of vegetables?
Yeah, it's a hard one, because we know, and everyone knows, that you should be eating more fresh vegetables and fruit, and they know that it's good for you. But unfortunately, as you point out, the recommended intake's 5 serves a day, and now that's been sliding backwards, and it looks like there's an average now of intake of 1.8 serves a day. So it's dramatically down from the recommended intake, and it's believed that 4.6% of children are taking the recommended intake of vegetables. So we know it's good for us, and relatively speaking, fruit and vegetable aren't that expensive compared to, say, your meat dishes out there where you're paying $30 to $40 a kilo. Most of the fruit and veg are less than $10 a kilo. So the cost isn't the inhibitor here, I don't think. I think it's really just people just need to be conscious and make a decision. So, we need to eat more healthily, and we need to put more vegetables on our plate. And even if we can just bump that serve up by one serve each, that would make a significant difference to the outcome and for the growers.
Do you think enough work is being done to stop growers from having these feelings of wanting to leave the industry, or does more need to be done?
There's always a little bit more that can be done. Just providing them with support and information as to what other mechanisms are available to them, ways to improve efficiency and work. There's always an opportunity for that. But again, that there isn't any silver bullet that's going to fix that. It's more of a broader issue where if we can bump up consumption, have greater awareness overall, that everyone needs to be aware that the food security of WA is at risk if we don't eat a little bit more healthy fruit and veg, but also just to work with the growers to improve their efficiency and the way that they work.
Vegetables WA CEO Peter Spackman speaking to Amelia Searson about AusVeg's Vegetable Industry Sentiment Report, which shows most growers are financially worse off than they were last year, and 40% are considering leaving the industry. 27 to 1, Lana Taranto is here with the news headlines. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. Coming up in the news, Federal Opposition Leader Susan Lee says she's increasingly worried about the government's 2035 climate target. The government yesterday announced the emissions reduction target of 62 to 70% based on 2005 levels. The coalition says it's concerned about the impact of the energy transition on power bills. The Water Corporation says the water supply of a major town in the Pilbara is at capacity and cannot accommodate any new major development. The information was revealed in a letter from the state-owned utility to the chief executive of the town of Port Hedland. In the letter, the corporation said it would not support a proposed expansion of the beachfront village accommodation development due to a water supply constraint issue caused by a demand on the source. And Australian cattle prices have increased following a fall in production in other beef-producing countries such as Brazil and New Zealand. Analysts say the US is now relying on Australian imports to rebuild its cattle herd after years of drought. Meat and Livestock Australia says a 10% US tariff on Australian beef has also led to higher prices. More news coming up at 1.
Lana, thank you so much for that update. 26 to 1.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Still to come, we'll get all the details of this week's wool sales with Danny Burkett just before 1. And then Those alarm bells, they are ringing because DPIRT's latest stock assessments show fish species like pink snapper, red emperor and jewfish are under a very serious threat. We'll get into that shortly. First, let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology. And Catherine Shelfout is with you today. Catherine, how's it looking around the Southwest Land Division?
Good afternoon, Belinda. Currently pretty cloudy over the Southwest Land Division and just a few showers near the south coast, but they are easing as a weak cold front moves away and we've got a ridge that's coming in. So that ridge will be the dominant feature for the next 4 days. So on Saturday, it will be lying over the Great Southern and extending east across the Goldfields and the Eucla. Sunday, we'll see it moving slowly south. And then by Monday, we've got a high pressure centre sitting in the Bight. It's about 1,036 hectopascals, so it's pretty strong for this time of year. And on Monday and Tuesday, we'll also see a little bit of a weak west coast trough forming. So the weather associated with that synoptic pattern is pretty straightforward. So I'll just do a quick run through the next 4 days. So Saturday, light winds across the Southwest Land Division. They'll generally be southwesterly if you're close to the south coast and southeasterly through the wheat belt and central west. Be quite cloudy close to the south coast and just a few light showers, but yeah, less than 2 millimetres expected there. Chance of morning fog through the southern half, mainly sort of south of about Perth to Norseman. And we're seeing minimum temperatures not being too cold, so 4 to 5 degrees through inland parts around Kellerberrin and Hyden. That's sort of the coldest region. And maximum temperatures ranging from about 18 at Katanning up to 24 at Meriden and 28 at Mullewa. So Sunday winds will still be quite light, a little bit more easterly, but southerly near the south coast. So just around Albany and Esperance and inland there will be some cloud and a few very light showers. But elsewhere, generally sunny. And we'll just see these maximum and minimum temperatures creeping up a degree or two each day. Once again, chance of morning fog or low cloud south of about Bunbury to Norseman. Monday, we'll see the winds turning a little bit easterly. They will be a bit stronger over northern parts of the central west, so sitting at around 25 to 30 kilometres per hour there in the morning. Easterly through remaining parts, but pretty light. Fog, again, possible, a similar area south of about Bunbury to Norseman, but any cloud is really just sort of east of Esperance by Monday. And then Tuesday, winds turning a little bit more northeasterly, so once again, a bit fresher through the central west in the morning, north of about Dongara, but pretty much sunny and dry throughout. Maximum temperatures looking at warmer again, particularly through southern central parts. So getting up to 27 at Hopetown on Tuesday. It does look like the hottest day will be Thursday, where temperatures get up into the 30s through the wheat belt and eastern parts, and then a very weak front coming through Thursday night into Friday.
And let's take a look around the rest of the state then into northern and eastern parts.
Yeah, so in the north, with that ridge over southern WA, we've had some pretty windy conditions this morning through the Gascoyne, the Pilbara and the north interior, and we'll see that continuing pretty much right through till Thursday next week. So Saturday and Sunday, we'll see winds sitting around, or mean winds around 30 kilometres per hour, some areas up to around 40, and that's mainly through the eastern Pilbara, southern Kimberley and north interior. And then on Monday and Tuesday, that area broadens out to cover all of the Pilbara, much of the Gascoyne and the southern Kimberley as well. So Tuesday will be the strongest day for those winds, and they do stay quite fresh and gusty, not just in the morning but throughout the whole day. So that's the day where we're likely to see highest fire dangers and probably extreme fire danger for the Headland District there on Tuesday. Temperatures drop back a little bit with those easterlies through the Kimberley and the Pilbara. But we do have a heat low over the Kimberley, so expect to see a few showers through the eastern Kimberley on Sunday and northwestern parts of the Kimberley Monday and Tuesday. They'll probably be a bit gusty and just a very slight chance that there might be a thunderstorm in those parts as well.
Thank you for those details, Catherine. Appreciate that. 21 to 1, Richard Hudson here now with the rainfall figures.
Yeah, there's not many to get through either. In the Southwest Land Division, in the lower west, Bungendore topped it with 4. in the southwest. 4 acres, 5 mils, Millianup 5 as well, Pemberton 6, Walpole Forestry 10 and Yanmar 5. Then in the southern coastal region, Albany 9, Denbarka 6 and Denmark 7. And I think that's about the only rainfall that's worth reading out. Just quickly though, in the first half, Bell, you mentioned the cockchafer problems in the Lakes District. No, I'm not going to say something juvenile. Can you remember Lucas Robinson, who we interviewed a while ago, about a year ago, I think, a young bloke whose family farms near the Lake Grace area? Pretty handy footy player. He's with Fremantle's Next Generation Academy. And I noticed a few weeks ago in a game playing for South Fremantle, 35 disposals, 12 tackles, bit of a tackling beast. Well, this Sunday, I'm hoping to watch him play in the Colts Grand Final against Claremont. So, yeah, good luck to him anyway.
Thank you for sharing that, Richard. 20 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Well, it was about 24 hours ago, wasn't it? The federal government announced it was committed to a target to cut emissions by 62 to 70% by 2035, based on 2005 levels. And Labor believes that target is ambitious, but also achievable. Some people believe the target is too low. Chris Bowen is the Minister for Climate Change and Energy, and this morning he was asked for his reaction to the opposition's view that the target is too high.
Well, Coalition doesn't believe in climate action. There's no surprise there, nor do they accept climate science. I mean, you know, when I released the National Risk Assessment earlier this week, they questioned the assumptions. And senior members of the Coalition questioned the science. I mean, these guys are just on the wrong side of modernity. And they will always play that cheap politics. What we will do is counter that with the facts.
In order to achieve the 2035 target, the landing of renewable and transmission lines will be a significant component. What assurances are you giving to the business and farming sectors on this?
Well, that's true, and I welcome, you know, I was pleased with the response of the farming community yesterday, National Farmers Federation, and the acting chief executive, Sue McCluskey, also the business community, which recognises that this is a big lift for the country. You know, the BCA, the Australian Industry Group, the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry all said, look, this is going to require a lot of work, a lot of investment, a lot of cooperation, but we believe it's achievable. I'm meeting later today with investor groups, business groups on rolling up the sleeves and getting on with the job of delivering these targets. As I said at the outset, you know, we don't pretend this is easy or automatic or not a big lift in national achievement, and it's going to require constant work.
Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen speaking to Sally Sara, and the Minister confident he has the support of the National Farmers Federation on this, saying groups like the NFF know it's going to be hard work, a big job, but the targets are achievable. And I just wanted to check what exactly the NFF did say in response to those targets announced yesterday. And the NFF's Interim Chief Executive, Sue McCluskey, said climate action is vital and agriculture is already actively contributing. It's encouraging to see our nation collectively striving for solutions with this 62 to 70% range target. And she said, while the NFF supports an economy-wide aspiration of net zero by 2050, it cannot be net zero for agriculture. And I wonder how accurately the NFF's policy position on climate matches your position. Let me know on the text 0448 922 604. What should the NFF's position on emissions and targets be? Let me know 0448 922 604. Well, shortly after speaking to the Climate Change and Energy Minister, Sally Sara had Nationals leader and Shadow Minister for Agriculture, David Littleproud, on for his response.
You've labelled this target as nothing more than a con job. What evidence do you have of that?
Well, it's labelled it as is an expensive charade because the detail that Chris Bowen doesn't want to talk about hasn't been put in those reports. But let's just start from the first premise before we go forward. I believe in climate change. I believe that man has made an impact on climate change. Just because I don't believe in Chris Bowen's plan doesn't mean I'm a climate denier. This puerile argument that Chris Bowen and Anthony Albanese and Jim Chalmers put up, that if they don't agree with them, that we're all climate deniers, is wrong. if you want leadership in this country, you've got to actually have intellectual rigour in your debate, not just go to puerile arguments. So let me make that very clear. We believe in climate change. We believe there's ways to do it, but not necessarily Labor's way. So what you can see in that report is if we are to go, if you do look at Labor's history, they haven't reduced emissions at all in the last 3 years. They've flatlined. And in fact, to get to the 2030 target, which they're not going to get to, they've got to get to 82% renewables. That's 22,000 solar panels a day. That's 40 wind turbines a month that need to be installed. And then to get to have a grid that gets to 90% renewables by 2035, 92%. There's no country in the world that's going to that.
National's leader and Shadow Agriculture Minister David Littleproud speaking to Sally Sarah on RN Breakfast this morning. 16 to 1. That is right. WA's Fisheries Department is definitely ringing the alarm bells this time. DPIRD's latest stock assessments show species like pink snapper, red emperor, and the iconic jewfish are under serious threat, even at risk of collapse. What do you think needs to be done here? Text through. If you've got an idea, let me know. 0448 922 604. Department of Fisheries Executive Director Nathan Harrison says previous attempts to reduce catches have failed, so they're considering implementing even stricter measures.
No, it hasn't been enough. We went from a two-month seasonal closure to a five-month closure. We also introduced new bag limits, boat limits. We don't control the number of people participating in recreational fishing. And in WA, just in the West Coast region, we've got about 40,000 people that like going out there fishing for these demersal scale fish. And unfortunately, while we were able to reduce catches to some extent, it just wasn't adequate to allow these fisheries to recover. And as a consequence, we still have a situation where the stocks have not been able to rebound. Fishing pressure is still too high. And we need to take management action to try and turn this around.
Have you made any recommendations to the government as to what we do next?
The first thing that the government is wanting to do is actually engage with the stakeholders and the community around getting a better understanding of the science and have an engagement process around saying, well, what are the decisions and what are the management options we've got for us? So there has been no decision made at this point of time on those management arrangements, but it's fair to say absolutely everything is on the table. And the minister has announced that there will be a forum, which is about the science and management, coming up on the 20th of October for the key stakeholders. There's a lot of information on our website, fact sheets, stock status, and also a Have Your Say link if people are interested in further information on the stock and the science summary. So that's all there. But certainly when you look at, fishing, I'm a keen recreational fisher myself, but, we need to get community involvement in this process. We need to make sure people are aware of the significance of the issues we face and also have an active discussion around those management solutions.
If everything's on the table, does that include a potential ban on demersal fishing?
As I said, the decisions that we make looking at those management options are going to have to be significant. And it's clear that, first of all, as I said, no decisions have been made, but all options to ensure that long-term sustainability need to be on the table, regardless of that is, a closure, for example. Those things need to be on the table and discussed.
Department of Fisheries Executive Director Nathan Harrison. Recfish West and WAFIC, the WA Fishing Industry Council, issued a joint statement saying they welcome the Minister's Forum in October to discuss possible options to address the challenges facing the state's demersal fisheries. Former WAFIC CEO Daryl Hockey now represents a think tank called Sustainable Seafood Australia. He thinks urgent and strong action is needed to replenish fish stocks and save the fisheries.
This is the crisis that I've been trying to avoid. I'm a recreational fisher. I live at Bremer Bay. I want my kids and grandkids to be able to go fishing, and that's why I've always been so passionate about getting these controls in place, because I've seen the real figures. And the trouble is that the figures we get are still not accurate from the recreational community because they don't report in real time. it's all done by sort of, you know, surveys and assessments.
Mm.
And I think if you found what the real catch rates were, it would be many times worse than what these numbers show. So I, you know, believe that the government's got two choices. Either they bring in compulsory, mandatory real-time reporting for the West Coast demersal boat fishery, or they shut the fishery down for the next 10 years. Because it's a waste of time having a forum and trying to bring in new management changes if you don't agree to bring in mandatory reporting. Because if you can't measure what you're taking, you can't manage it. And you can't go complaining to Minister Jarvis if she's got to bring in these changes. She's inherited this stinking mess. It's not her fault. And I'll give her credit for at least bringing all the stakeholders together for the forum and trying to make sure that, you know, we can get some common sense will apply.
Daryl Hockey from Sustainable Seafood Australia speaking to Gary Adshead on Perth Drive yesterday, 10 minutes to one. Not everyone is convinced it's time to hit the panic button or the alarm bells. Among the species rated as high risk are the Kimberley Red Emperor and Pilbara Gold Band Snapper. Kimberley commercial fisherman Grant Barker is sceptical that Red Emperor stocks are under threat.
Look, I can only speak for the fishery that we hold authorities in, which is the Northern Demersal Scale fishery, where they're suggesting that the Red Emperor stocks are under threat. I would disagree with that. In that fishery in particular, with regard to Red Emperor, and I've been fishing in there for 20 years commercially, I think there are a few areas where there's localised depletion, where we might have fished a couple of areas too hard, and those areas may need to be closed spatially to give them a chance to recover. But we only fish about 10% of that entire area of that fishery anyway. So to suggest that the Red Emperor stocks are under threat, I think is a long shot.
Have you seen those numbers sort of change when you're out there?
No, not really. If you fish the same area constantly, you will see numbers change over time. We tend to keep moving around and move into areas that have never previously fished, and we find excellent stocks of Red Emperor. So, you know, I'm not concerned about the Red Emperor stocks. It'd be nice to think that we get consulted properly about this, and we've been nervous about this because it's been mooted that, you know, there's going to be some changes and some closures and a whole lot of Chinese whispers. We just hope we get the opportunity to sit down with the government and the minister and work through this sensibly. It'd be nice.
What impact could a decision by the government to possibly ban or reduce fishing of Red Emperor fish have on your business and livelihood?
If they decide that we have to do something to catch less Red Emperor, then we have to do something to catch less Red Emperor, and we would fish other areas and target other species, which we can do. We know how to catch Red Emperor. We know how to catch Goldband Snapper. We know how to catch a whole suite of different demersal species, and we would change our fishing strategies to not target Red Emperor in that instance. It's not necessary to wholesale cut licences out or cut percentages of licences out. It's about changing the strategies you use to target different species. And as commercial operators in the NDSF, we have the ability to do that.
Grant Barker is a director of Northern Wildcatch Seafood Australia, which fishes for Red Emperor, Gold Band Snapper and other demersal species in Northern Australia. He was speaking to Dunya Karadzic about fears WA demersal species are under threat. And as you heard, Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis has said she's convening a Fishing Futures Forum. It's going to be held on Monday, October the 20th, to discuss the science and management options. It will be interesting to hear what comes out of that. And if you were to attend, what would you be requesting at this point? The text 0448 922 604. And just on that, a few texts on the subject of what to do about these fish stocks and the threats. It's going to be interesting to see how far Twiggy Forest's aquaculture projects will balloon now in WA. Fancy that. This also, what a joke, protect sharks, one of the apex fish in the ocean whose population has exploded, and then blame the recreational fishermen for overfishing. And this too from Jim. I know it sounds a bit odd, but humans don't live in the ocean and we're not part of the ocean ecosystem. Of course, there's going to be eventually become a problem. Humans are the problem. Improving stocks can only be achieved by not fishing, or how else can you do it, says Jim. And we also were talking about net zero and the target set by the federal government yesterday to cut emissions by 62 to 70% by 2035 based on 2005 levels, and checking the NFF's response to this announcement yesterday. And Liam wanted to have his say there. The NFF has gone woke like the rest. Climate has been changing for billions of years. How arrogant of us to think we make a difference. The text is 0448 922 604. Well, brownouts, power surges and blackouts that last for days are a fact of life for the residents of Walpole on Western Australia's south coast. But after 3 years in the making, a local engineer has built a world-first green energy solution that will deliver instant electricity to the town where the grid supply fails.
So we have a lower dam here, and then we have an upper dam, which is at the top of a hill. We pump water from the lower dam to the upper dam through a pump, and that takes energy to do that. So we take that electricity either from solar power or from surplus power in the grid. This pump, we can then operate that in reverse as a generator or a turbine. And in doing that, we operate for energy storage in the same way that a battery operates, where we can take that energy, store it in water, and then recover it out of the water and pump it back into the grid. So this is why it's called a hybrid, like a hybrid car. It's the battery that takes up all the fluctuations, and we use the pump turbine for the bulk energy storage. Now, if there is an outage and the grid supply trips, then we can take up that supply to the town, and then we continue to supply the town like an uninterruptible power supply that you might have on your computer at home.
Denmark's Colin Stonehouse. And you can see his amazing green energy project at Walpole on ABC TV's Landline this Sunday, 12:30, or catch it later on iView. And that report by Mark Bennett. To the wool market now, and it's up again this week. The Eastern Market Indicator up 25 cents to close at 1,344 cents a kilo clean, and the Western Market Indicator up 16 cents to finish the week on 1,480 cents a kilo clean. Danny Burkett, another great week.
Another very good week in wool through the three centres. Fremantle was a one-day sale on the Tuesday. 17 micron up 15 to close at 18.30. And if we look back from the 1st of July, from when this season started, that is $2.05 clean, better than when we started, or roughly $265 a bale at a 70% yield. 18 micron up 30 for the week, closing at 17.45. That is also $2.05 clean, better than when we started from the 1st of July. 19 micron up 10 for the week to close at 16.30. That is $1.40 better, as are 20 and 21 microns than the 1st of July, so roughly $180 a bale better at 185 kilo bale. 20 microns up 5 to close at 15.75, and 21 stay above that magical $15. They closed 15 dirha at 15.45. Pieces and bellies across the board, regardless of length and VM, plus 20 cents on the fines, plus 10 on the mediums. And that leaves the spread between pieces and fleece at $1.20 on a 19 micron. Historically, that is getting back to a relatively normal level, so that is great to see in the market. Oddments back, what have we got? Stains, locks, crutchings, all 5 to 10 cents dearer. Lambs insufficient to quote at this stage, but that will change very shortly over the next 2 weeks. We'll be able to get a good idea of where they're trading. So a very positive market in Fremantle. That also continued in Sydney and Melbourne on the second day, because they had a two-day sale. They were dearer again, especially on the finer end. At some point, they were roughly 30 to 40 to 50 clean better than where the market finished on the Tuesday in Fremantle. So very positive result across the Merino microns in Fremantle, Melbourne and Sydney. And just a quick touch, if you are at that crossbred end, 28 and 30 microns also very positive for the week. The 28 micron closed over $6 clean. That is the first time in a very long time.
And the usual buyers around this week, Danny?
Yes, we had Techwool. Certainly, they took 17 or just over 17% of the merino fleece wool on offer. PJ Morris, the West Australian-based business, 13.5%. Mellower, 11.5%, and TNU. Good to see them back in the mix at 11.5%. Also, it's good to see two different exporters come in at third and fourth spot. It just shows to me that there's a fair amount of competition from the Chinese at the moment. Merino skirting's worth mentioning. Techwool trading the largest buyer at 23.5%. Techwool trading the largest buy in the crossbred market as well. So very strong for Techwool across the country again.
And what are your expectations for next week then? Is this run going to continue?
Well, to my mind, this market's been driven by three things, and that is supply, supply, and supply. And next week, we still only have just over 30,000 bales on the market. And when we get to each sale day, we have roughly 3 or 4% withdrawn prior to sale. We have 3 or 4% passed in, so we'll be below that 30,000 mark. It's a one-day sale again in Fremantle. So if we look back at what's been happening with the supply in the wool market that's been driving us, it bodes very well as we head into next week.
Thank you so much for that, Danny. It's certainly on a roll at the moment, isn't it, that wool market? Great to talk to you today and this week. It's news time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.